Welcome to the Aurelium Future Strategy Podcast, the definitive podcast for strategic insights in the world of professional services. At the Aurelium Future Strategy Podcast, we bring together the brightest minds in industry and academia, offering you a unique blend of pragmatic insights and expert solutions. Our aim is to empower you with the knowledge and strategies that are both forward-thinking and actionable. Whether you're looking to understand the latest trends, enhance your firm's strategic planning, or gain a competitive edge in your field, this podcast is your essential guide.
Rob, another exciting interview, this time with Luann Buckley, Chief Marketing and Communications Officer. Some other things that potentially we can look at before we jump to your interview with Luann, which was fascinating and something that I think falls alongside that discussion, is the recent Riyadh edict. And obviously, we don't have time to jump into the whole complicated situation that is occurring there. But just your one sentence, one take, because it does have to do with branding, it does have to do with corporate positioning, both of which fall under the CMO role. Your one sentence response to companies who have, I will say, capitulated to the Riyadh edict.
Be cautious in the way in which you go to market and make sure that you have reviewed all your public material before making any announcement about your decision in regard to that particular jurisdiction. And have a look at your article on geopolitical risk. I think it is a very good guideline for professional service firms that are operating in an increasingly complex environment. So a good guideline and something very much to be taken note of.
Look at that, a little bit of a shameless plug here on the Aurelium Future Strategy Podcast. And another one directly following that, we also have an incredible guest contributor to our upcoming monthly leadership publication, Professor Tazeeb Rajwani. He dives a little bit deeper into the Riyadh edict and geopolitics and how that can relate to firms and firms operating at a global level. But leaving that aside, but do check it out. Rob, tell us a little bit about Luann before we jump into your interview.
Yeah, Luann is an incredibly experienced marketing and communication officer. She comes with a host of ideas and thoughts. I would call her out particularly insofar as her strategy and business acumen is concerned. You'll hear in the podcast how she highlights the importance of being business-minded before marketing. So in other words, you approach it from a business perspective before you start thinking about marketing. She is an inspirational leader, and she has led very successful teams within the professional service sector and outside of the professional service sector. She also brings a slightly unique perspective in the sense that she is also a board director, so she has the company side of it, the client side of it, front of mind always. And also, as you listen to the podcast, what you'll see is the idea of data-driven insights. In other words, leveraging the data within the organization to make sure that you are positioning the firm in the right way in the different markets in which you go into. But from a specific contextual perspective, Luann was a CMO at one of the big four, PwC. So she brings a very interesting take on the comparison between the approach that the big four take to institutionalizing their clients. And then she was also a CMO at one of the large global law firms, Norton Rose Fulbright in Canada, where I was fortunate to spend a little bit of time with her in a working environment. And I must say, incredibly impressive in the fresh way of thinking that she brought into the organization and explained very simply the strategic imperative of having a business-minded CMO. So we covered a fairly wide range of topics, but it was focused around what the professional service firms can do to improve their marketing, how they can improve their positioning within the markets in which they operate. We looked at activation. We looked at the contrast between globalization and localization. So a really fascinating conversation, and one that I think law firm partners, and I use the term very deliberately, partners rather than necessarily only management teams, will find particularly interesting. Because as you will hear in the podcast, I do think that it's one of those topics that law firm partners in particular need to get a handle on pretty quickly, given the pace of change, and that is to bring in the right skills to the organization, but then to empower those skilled individuals to actually drive the change that you hope they will drive rather than bring in the individuals and then try and tell them how they should be doing their jobs. Because let's face it, not all of us are expert marketers, not all of us are expert lawyers or accountants, but we need to start actually recognizing the skill sets that we've got in our organizations and then empowering them to drive the change that we hope they will change. So a great conversation, and very grateful to Luann for her time and expertise.
And I think that's something that's quite interesting there, because it ties into your previous conversation with Peter, insofar as marketing goes so much further than what I think many people think, and it begins to encapsulate and cover areas of brand, of corporate culture, of how it is that the firm is at its root, which is quite interesting. And it also ties in quite nicely to our next interview with Rebecca. So do keep your eyes and ears peeled for that. But again, without further ado, I'm going to toss it back for your fantastic interview with Luann.
Luann, great to be with you this morning. Thank you for making time very early in the morning in Toronto. Great to have a Canadian guest on the show and to hear about things that are not specific necessarily to just law firms, but expand across professional service firms, in the sense that you have been on both sides of the professional service fence. So very grateful for your time, and very good to have you with us.
Happy to be here.
I'm going to start with a very basic question. And the reason that I'm starting with a basic question is that it constantly fascinates us how, when you get into a conversation with a partner within a professional service firm, and it doesn't matter whether you're talking to a partner in an accounting business or a legal business, there still seems to be some level of confusion about what the chief marketing officer role is within a professional service organization. It ranges from, oh yes, that's the person that takes care of the publicity, to that is a very strategic role and we take very clear guidance from our CMO. How would you articulate the proposition of a CMO in 2024 in a professional service organization?
So first, I would say, Rob, that confusion exists in every organization. And the role of the CMO is probably the most ill-defined, or there's multiple versions of it. And that's because it depends on what that organization's strategy is. I think in professional services firms, and one size definitely doesn't fit all, I think what you've seen historically is that it has been a lot of branding and events, sponsorships, maybe some email marketing. It's then sort of progressed into more integrated campaigns, you know, all the way through the funnel from brand awareness to conversion. In my view, a really effective chief marketing officer today, whether it's in a professional service firms or otherwise, is multidimensional. It's leveraging the data insights and the technology and bringing those insights to the table. They're helping form the strategy. So what does the firm want to be known for? What do they want to be recognized for? What is the source of growth? From what markets? From what sectors? From what client segments? And so that's really a more strategic role. And then they're bringing those insights and they're developing the strategies so that the marketing strategies have more firm-based outcomes. It's not just, I did this beautiful branding campaign, or I put on this amazing event, or what have you. It's much more multidimensional.
That is music certainly to our ears, because I think you know that we are very strong advocates of having highly skilled strategic leadership within professional service organizations, and leadership at every level, not necessarily just in the CMO function, but across all the different areas of the firm. You mentioned the role of a CMO in strategic direction, and we would agree with the proposition that says if you are going to be responsible for driving issues like brand, like market profile, like segment analysis and the like, you need to be, one, embedded in the strategy, two, understand the strategy, and three, be part of setting the strategy, because you have an understanding of the different market dynamics. It seems to us, though, that there is still a resistance among some professional service firms to include the CMO role as a key component of the management team, in the sense of sitting on MCOMs. And I wonder if you can just talk through why you see the CMO as being so critical to that strategic element.
So first, what I'll say is, you know, I only have 12 months experience in the legal sector, but in my 12 months, one of the things that lawyers often said to me is, I went to law school, not business school. And as you well know from your experience, Rob, is a lot of lawyers start as a student. They article at the same firm. They've only ever worked at a law firm. So if you don't know what marketing can do, you really don't know what they should be doing. I think the role of the CMO, it is very strategic in terms of setting the strategic direction, understanding the sources of growth. You have to be business-minded first, not marketing first. So what business outcomes are you trying to drive? And then what marketing strategy best gets you there? And what's your right marketing mix? If you don't have that at the table, then marketing is really just tactical. And you're reduced to doing what lawyers, accountants, partners want that they think is important or that they have a personal interest in. I want to sponsor this golf tournament because we do it every year. Or I want to run an ad so people know that we do that. Well, that might not be the best tactic depending on the why are you doing it? What is the objective that you're trying to achieve? So the more you can influence the strategy, the better you're able to connect to and deliver against that firm-wide outcome.
Makes absolute sense. And I think the key point that you made there was business-minded first before marketing. I think you touch on a topic that I've got no doubt that many leaders across professional service firms will be experiencing or have experienced in their careers. And that is that, yes, we've got highly skilled people in the organization that have been trained to do a particular job in the sense of lawyering or accounting or whatever it might be. And they find it very difficult to understand that the other professional skill sets within the organization have also been trained on the things that they don't understand, and they should take guidance rather than say, go and book the next golf tournament because that's what we've always done. Well, the other favorite one from our side is, but that's what our competitors do. So we must go and book the golf event.
Well, and that's a great mistake that marketers make, right? Or even business people make. They spend more time focused on their competitors and what the competitors are doing versus what their customers want and need and value.
That's a great segue into the next point that we want to have a look at, and that is the client piece. We, as professional service organizations, and it doesn't matter which side of the sector that you're playing, whether it's accounting, consulting, legal, all of us will say the same thing in one form or another. We are client-centric. We put our clients first. We are all about clients. And yet you make a very interesting observation, and it's one that we see time and time and time again. The sense is we know what our clients want. We're not particularly interested in hearing what our clients want because we know what our clients want. We are the experts. How do you feed back into the environment, the feedback that you're getting from clients? What is the value of a proper client feedback strategy that informs the firm strategy because it's based on the feedback that you're getting from your clients?
I think the first thing you have to do is define what clients you want feedback from, right? And it goes back to the firm strategy. Where do you want to grow? So clients in what sector, clients in what practice area, you know, clients that you want to grow over time, right? Versus every client. So I would say there's a segmentation that you have to do and you give more weight to, you know, your priority clients, say, or the segment that you want to grow the most. That's where the feedback is the most important. So the more customer knowledge you can bring to the table that allows the practitioner, whether it's a lawyer or an accountant or a consultant, to have a more informed conversation, to ask more open-ended questions, to really delve into what would add the most value to this client, the more value you're adding then to that practitioner because you're opening it up, right? You're now just saying, okay, maybe I'm the subject matter expert in this, but if they're being held accountable for XYZ, maybe by bringing in others, whether it's a partner in the same firm or an external partner, you're helping them put the dots together to get to a bigger outcome. But that only comes from taking that feedback, right? And I think feedback at every point in the cycle is so important, right? From the proposal and doing the pitch to win-loss reviews to customer satisfaction interviews to regular executive one-on-one touch points at every level. And if you're not capturing those data points and those insights and really understanding the trends, then I would say you really don't understand the customer. You're leaving money on the table.
Two things sort of strike me from that. As professionals within organizations, we are too quick to focus on our individual relationship with the client rather than the whole relationship with the client. And secondly, we need to remember that our role and part of the value that we bring is to make whoever it is within our client's organization make their lives easier, make them look good to whoever it is that they're reporting to, but very importantly, institutionalizing that relationship between the two organizations, between the client and the professional service firm, the law firm or the accounting firm. And maybe that leads to another query that I have. I see the accounting firms as being far more effective at institutionalizing client relationships than I see in law firms. And if you look at the widespread of law firms that do business for corporates, so one corporate will have, 13, sometimes up to 45 law firms that they use for particular services or particular purposes, and yet they will have one consulting firm, one accounting firm, maybe two. Is there a difference from your experience, having worked in the accounting sphere and having worked in the legal sphere? Do you see a difference? And is there any improvement that the legal sector and law firms could make in that regard?
I think the accounting firms are further ahead in terms of understanding and recognizing clients as a firm-wide client, right? So it's not, Luann, I own the client, this is my client. This is a firm client and we all have shared ownership of that client and we all can make them successful, to your point. And the more we pool our expertise, the more successful we make our client. I think that's number one. I think number two is, I think professional services firms, especially accounting firms, or the big four at least, take a much more holistic approach to client growth. Right. So they understand what the client's objectives are. They know what's driving their strategy. They know what outcomes they're trying to achieve. And they map, okay, this is where our capabilities can help them and succeed. Right. So I can bring together consulting and assurance and tax and transactions capabilities of each of those lines of service to deliver a better outcome. So I think they've done a better job of pulling that together. Whereas I think traditionally law firms, and some are better than others, are still very siloed in terms of their lines of service.
Yeah. And frankly, if you cut through everything else, therein lies the opportunity for the law firms, because the law firms that can get that right will see a marked benefit in that particular way of operating in comparison to the siloed approach.
Yeah, it's a mindset shift and a strategic approach to clients and what clients you want to grow and where you want to grow them.
I think that's right. It's a mind shift that will require some pretty fundamental changes to many ways in which law firms operate, including compensation systems, measurement systems, performance management, training of juniors. They come in and they train very quickly to deliver your hours, which becomes a very individual approach rather than a collective approach. So clearly something that the legal sector is going to have to grapple with if there is an interest in making that change and getting that particular issue sorted out. If we then look at some of the specifics, and again, this is a standard answer that we get from many of our professional service clients, particularly in the legal sector. Oh, yes, but that's a soft issue. How do we ever measure the return on the investment that we've made in our marketing team, in our PR, in our CMO role? What is your answer to that? I mean, it's a conversation I know that you've had on a number of occasions. Your sense of it, what is the advice that you would give to law firm partners, and how would you articulate that particular proposition?
It has to go back to the strategy. So what needle are we trying to move? So are we trying to raise the profile of the firm in specific practice areas? Then you can measure that. You can measure that with brand awareness. You can measure that with share of voice. You can measure that with actual revenue growth in those practice areas, right? If your objective is to generate revenue in a specific area, then you have to show what impact you're having that generates growth. Now, sales is never solely attributed to marketing. So it's an art and a science. But if you tie your marketing dollars to what needle you're trying to move, then it's easier to show. But what's most important is getting clarification, right? What is your objective and what am I measuring against? And I think that's where CEOs and CMOs have the most friction, is aligning along objectives and aligning on how you're going to measure it. Otherwise, there's misunderstanding, misalignment, and confusion.
I'm going to add to that, the misalignment between managing partner, partners, and CMO. And I mean, it is direct experience where you have a very clear mandate coming into an organization for your CMO, which has actually been approved because all the partners recognize the need for that particular skill set. And yet within 6 to 12 months, the partners have decided, oh, well, we're not actually seeing an immediate return. We don't understand what the person's doing. Managing partner, you know, this is a problem. So I do think that short-term thinking can also be very detrimental to a long-term strategic plan to drive the growth and to deliver the return that you are looking to measure.
Yeah, and marketing is a long game, right? That doesn't mean you can't deliver short-term results, right? But it goes back to your point. You have to have absolute clarity, right? So if you're on a three-year journey to build your brand in specific areas and grow specific segments, then you have to understand what are the milestones that you can measure along the way that show progress. And it's up to the CMO to be having those conversations with the managing partner to say, okay, we're on track, right? We've moved the needle this far. We have this far to go, and here's how we're going to get there. You can't just disappear and go do your thing and assume they recognize you for the work that you're doing.
Heaven forbid that that would ever happen.
Right.
Can we move to a slightly more nuanced conversation? Maybe it's a difficult question to ask you, but most professional service firms in one way or another operate with clients that are not necessarily country or region specific. They span different countries, different regions. And in many instances, and certainly in your experience, you've operated within global organizations that have very different and diverse practices across multiple regions. As the CMO of one of that sort of organization, how do you balance the tensions between a very local and very needed local approach, a global approach, global cultures versus local cultures, but then also the very, and I would say rightly, jealously guarded sense of self within a particular jurisdiction. And at the same time, you are trying to strategize, manage, deliver results that span across all of those different elements of a global organization. How do you deal with that in practice as a CMO?
Very delicately. Again, it's an art and a science, right? So I think in a global organization, you have to make a decision. Are you a branded house? Do you have one brand where you want to show up consistently in every region, in every practice line, you know, in every segment, in every corner of the world, both with customers in your communities and as a talent brand, as an employer? If that's the case, then you have to be true to what that brand is. What does it stand for? What are the values? What are the attributes? What is the visual identity? That's consistent no matter what. Where the magic comes in is giving each region, I'll say, or country, the ability to activate and localize. So for instance, Australia might have a capability that nobody else has. You have to allow them to market that capability within the constructs of the broader brand. Diversity and inclusion has different issues and characteristics in every geography of the world, right? The issue they have in South Africa is very different than what we do in Canada. How you attract talent, how you activate that or bring that to life, you can do through copy, through different visuals, through different ways of bringing the brand to life, different activations, but your brand is consistent. Your values are consistent. Your attributes are consistent. So it's understanding what is non-negotiable and what is customizable based on your needs.
In that answer, I actually, if we could extract that answer and use that to articulate the proposition that supports the fact that the CMO role is a key strategic role within a professional service firm, that in itself is the answer. You talk about activation, you talk about brand, you talk about culture, you talk about talent, you talk about positioning. All of those are the key themes that run throughout any strategy that a firm will be running. And in every single one of those instances, the CMO has to be able to work out in each of those elements what is the appropriate way to position the firm.
And you have to understand not only your global strategy, but your local strategy, right? So yeah. Where is Australia's money coming from? Where do they need to show up as an employer or in their community? That is very different than maybe what the United States is doing. So understanding those sources of growth, but understanding also at a global level, what is consistent and that you want to be known for globally.
Really what that demonstrates to me is that if you as a professional service organization are going to keep your CMO sidelined from strategy, it's almost impossible for the CMO to play a meaningful role in the true sense of the word.
That's right. Yeah. It's interesting if you think about, I know this is a far cry from professional services, but if you look at McDonald's, right, they just eliminated their global CMO role. What they did is they took that CMO and they made them a CEO in one of their regional businesses. So now they have presidents of each of their regions who own the growth strategy, the market positioning, the brand. McDonald's brand is never going to change, right? But how you activate it, that's what they've decided is really important for regional growth, which is the future of their business model.
That's absolutely right. And that is a very stark difference in the sense of, you know, the sense that a CMO and a marketing team, generally speaking, is a burden. It's a cost to the business rather than it is a strategic value add to the business. But more importantly, it is a strategic value add to the clients of the business if it's done right and if it's given the opportunity. When you talk about activation, I understand the concept of activation, but talk me through some of the specifics. You mentioned copy, but if I were to say to you, we are going to be moving into jurisdiction X, how do you propose that we activate our strategy or the key components of our strategy? What would be some of the elements? And don't feel you have to give us a definitive answer, but I mean, just a sense of what that may look like.
I mean, if you look at the entire buyer cycle, right, or you look at your traditional funnel, you're doing everything from brand awareness, right? So you may be doing an advertising campaign or having your brand show up in specific events. You may be doing webinars and educating around your capabilities and your practice areas. It could be thought leadership. It could be social media engagement. It could be one-on-one conversations. It could be, you know, how you show up in a pitch or proposal. It could be anything all the way down that funnel. Your brand is every moment, really, that you are taking an action internally or externally. Everybody always thinks your brand is the identity, the visual, the logo. It's not. It's the way every single person within an organization behaves, acts, makes decisions. It's probably one of the most intangible assets an organization has.
I very much appreciate that last bit of your answer. That frames our next conversation that we're going to be having with Rebecca Price on brand. It is a fascinating topic in its own right. The lack of real understanding of, one, what brand actually is in the professional service sector, and two, the value of brand to the partners, to the people, and to the clients. And I think you framed that in a very neat way, in the sense that it's not just the logo, it's not just the color scheme, it's not just the visuals. It is every element of the business.
It's the promise to your customer or to your people in the event of a, you know, talent brand.
It does seem to us that in a world that is now increasingly online, increasingly digital, that the lines between organizations are blurring, in the sense that everyone is expected to be a good lawyer. Everyone is expected to be a good accountant if you're working for one of the law firms or accounting firms. That sense of brand becomes a very key differentiator for the client that is buying the services.
Yeah, and it's the characteristics of the brand. It's the integrity of your people. It's the decisions you make. It's, are you always going to do the right thing? Will you walk away from business for the right reasons.
Walking away from business is a topic all of its own. So we'll steer clear of that for the moment.
Let's pass on that one.
I just want to look at how you have gone about in your career thus far with professional service organizations, and it doesn't matter. I mean, both on the accounting side and the legal side. How do you go about it at a personal level, convincing those conservative, fairly cautious, risk-averse partners? And you mentioned, you know, the idea that, well, we have to do it because that's what we've always done, and I have to be at the golf event or whatever it may. How do you convince those partners of the need for a different approach, for a modern approach to deliver the value that you are talking about, the branding and everything that goes with it?
I would say accountants are numbers-based people, and I would say lawyers are evidence-based people, right? So you have to take them the data, right? You have to show them what the case is for doing a specific thing, and then how you're going to measure it and what the results are. And you have to really socialize. So in every partnership, you know this better than anybody, right? It's socialization, consultation, communication, right? But you have to take them the facts. Otherwise, it is a personal reaction. It's, you know, it comes from their gut versus from their head. So what data are you giving them that helps make the case for what you want to do? And how are you going to prove that you delivered at the end of the day? Now, you always get into a debate about the data, but the good thing is we have more data than ever.
And how would you use that data? I mean, how is it that you would extract? I mean, presumably it's client-specific, it's sector-specific, but give us a practical example of how you would use that data to demonstrate the value proposition. What is the sort of data that you would be looking for?
Depends what you're trying to do, right? So if you look at your brand, if you want to build your brand, then look at the market research. How is your brand currently showing up? What is it recognized for? I would say the biggest thing on brand is customer perception and customer surveys. What do they know us for? What do they perceive us for? What do they value about us? What do they think of us, right? And it goes back to what customers are you trying to build brand with? You have to take that data and say, oh, you think that we're the number one law firm in M&A or the number one accounting firm in tax. Well, you know what? Our customers actually don't recognize us for that. Why is that? You know, who do they recognize? Who are they buying from? You have to take them the facts, because practitioners naturally only look at it from their experience delivering a service to their specific client. They're not looking at the broad market. So that's the power that the data is opening up their mind.
I'm asking this question slightly facetiously, but I'm going to ask it anyway. How many times is the response to that, the data must be wrong?
Almost always. It takes a lot of patience and, like I said, a lot of consultation, socialization, communication, right? At the end of the day, it's a compromise. It's a journey, and you've got to bring the partners along with you.
There has to come a point in time, and I think some professional service firms are doing better than others, but there has to come a point in time when partners stop instinctively saying, I don't agree with you because I have my own view of it, rather than saying, yes, you are the expert. Tell me, help me, assist me, and they will then see the result if they actually fall in behind rather than try and push back. But as I say, that's an entirely, you know, different topic, and one that both of us would have seen extensively throughout our careers.
Yeah, and that's a change management journey, right? And that has to be a strategic decision on the firm and the direction that they want to go in.
You manage fairly diverse teams across multiple offices. The teams that you are responsible for have got differing skill sets. They've got people that are very focused and specialize in PR. They might specialize in visual branding, whatever it might be. What's your management style? How do you make sure that your people feel stimulated professionally, particularly in difficult organizations where, let's be honest, there's not always a great deal of thanks given for specific tasks? It's a kind of expectation. How do you deal with that? And what's your management style of addressing those particular issues?
There's a lot packed into that question, Rob. I think first and foremost, everybody needs a North Star to rally around. So they need to know why they exist, what success looks like, and how they're going to work together to execute against that. I think from a development perspective, it's giving them the permission to be curious and the space to experiment. You have to allow them to have bold ideas, try new approaches, experiment, fail fast, adapt, learn, you know, adjust in a way that you're managing risk. Like, you're never putting the firm's reputation on the table, but try new things, right? And people, number one, just want to be appreciated and know they're doing a good job. But two, they're curious creatures. They want to know, are there other ways of doing it? There's lots of great external training and development out there for marketers, right? It's allowing that, it's putting those development plans in place, but more importantly, it's giving them this space to be curious and experiment and work together.
I agree with the sentiment. I would have thought that it sometimes comes out pretty difficult to implement in a professional service environment where you've got partners that are not necessarily always keen on seeing people doing things which are, you know, may fail because they are so risk averse and they prefer to see things work the first time.
Look, at PwC Canada, we advertised during the Olympics for the first time ever. We did TV advertising. We didn't know we were going to get a return. Turned out to be amazing, but they were willing to take the risk because they wanted a flash when we launched our new brand and our new strategy. There's smaller ways that you can experiment and do things that, you know, the lawyers will never know if you failed at, right?
That is absolutely true. I don't suppose any conversation these days that doesn't mention the topic of AI and particularly Gen AI, you feel that if you don't discuss it, you must have forgotten something terribly important. There is so much going on at the moment in the marketing digital space around Gen AI. I think you will agree it's almost daily that we are seeing some new AI tool that is released as being the panacea to all problems relating to marketing, websites, data, comms. What is your current sense of market maturity? And what is your sense of what's out there at the moment?
I think AI is probably the most mature in marketing. There are organizations that have been using AI in marketing for several years now. JP Morgan Chase uses a tool to help them develop more effective ads, writes copy for them. So they put out an ad, they measure sentiment of the audience of the ad, and it automatically corrects to increase sentiment or engagement. They've been doing that for years. AI is built into CRMs like Salesforce, where it's helping you, you know, mine the data, share insights, clean up data. I don't think we really know what the potential of AI is in marketing yet. I would say, number one, it's probably around data and insights and reporting and the ability to measure. Two, it's around helping write copy, whether it's pulling information together for a proposal or a pitch, whether it's doing a first draft of a social media post, whether it's actually taking all the information you give it and doing a submission to a legal directory. How are you using it? How are you training it? How do you make it smarter? It is going to continue to allow us to have smarter, richer conversations with our clients. And that allows the practitioners, whether you're an accountant, a consultant, or a lawyer, to be better at what they do because you're focused on that conversation and that value-add advice versus maybe doing the research or, you know, the drafting or the, you know, whatever.
So you would be a proponent, as are we, you would be a proponent for it's augmenting the human rather than replacing the human.
100%. At the end of the day, AI is only as smart as the human using it.
No doubt correct, and certainly for a long time to come. I'm very grateful for the time that you've given us. I do think it's a conversation that we need to be having more and more these days, and that is we do need to recognize the fact that the pace of change does dictate that we've got to actually allow the people that have got the skill sets, just as we have the skill sets when it comes to accounting or law, the people that have got the skill sets in marketing, business development, and the like, we've got to give them the opportunity to deliver what we hope they will deliver, but we've got to support them. But it has been a fascinating conversation and incredibly useful. great to see you, and we wish you well in your future ventures now that you've got some time on your hand to think about things, although it doesn't sound like you're going to be too quiet for too long. But hopefully we can have you back at some point and we can catch up on further things marketing related in the future.
I would love that. Thank you.
As we close this episode, we want to thank you, our listeners, for joining us through the ever-changing landscape of professional strategy. Remember, the world of professional services is continuously evolving, and success lies in anticipating and adapting to these changes. Our conversations here are designed to stimulate debate, encourage questions, and shed some light on the conversations the sector should be having. This is the Aurelian Future Strategy Podcast, where the future of professional strategy comes into focus.